So today, I'm preaching, I think, my first ever sermon on hell. Very exciting day in my life. I'm actually, in that I've kind of put this off for like 20 years of preaching, I'm not alone. People seem to either not talk very much about whatever they think hell is or isn't, or they bring it up a lot. And if you're like me, the people that bring this topic up a lot, they seem, I don't know, not all that healthy about that fixation. You may think of people who try to convert others outside of sporting events, like with wearing placards and passing out brochures, or you may think about the folks who pay for highway billboards in other parts of the country warning people about hell. I've discovered recently taking my daughter on some college trips outside New England that now and then you'll see like a road sign that's like, warning, construction site ahead. And then you'll look up higher and there'll be another kind of different sign that's like, warning, hell may be up ahead. And you're like, woo, bracing. All this makes me think of one other reason that people either talk a lot about hell or almost never, is that many people with a lot of thoughts or a lot to say about hell seem to be really clear on who is going there, and surprise, it's usually not them. So despite all this, maybe some of my hesitations, which I'm voicing up front, with a little fear and trembling, here we go. I thought today, what the hell? Oh, I'm so glad you thought that was funny. I was like, that's so corny. It's like my one-line joke, and I loved it, and it totally worked. That, like, made my day. All right. All right, quick thing up front. If you know Reservoir Church very well, or if you know me, this will not at all surprise you, but this sermon may not be entirely predictable or conventional along this along these lines. And depending on where you're coming from on this topic, I may have something to say that will be outright surprising or perhaps even difficult for some of us. What can I promise is I'm not like making anything up today. Everything I have to say in these sermons, as always, our whole preaching team actually, this is our best attempt to teach the Bible in light of the life and teachings of Jesus in an accessible and timely and hopefully interesting manner. To do so in a way that is representative, at least parts, of the Christian tradition, and to make space as we talk for our community and for each of us individually to try to pay attention to God's voice and God's invitation to help us engage constructively in the deep and important aspects of making meaning and trying to flourish in our lives. And so if all that is happening, as I hope it will be today, it never much matters. I want to be explicit about this now and then. It never much matters in our preaching whether you agree with me or any other preacher on every particular point. That is actually not our goal. Whether you agree all with one another or not, also not our goal. Reservoir Church is never about conformity. We are about connection with one another and with God. So all that said up front, I want to get right into today's passage from the lectionary. It's the church's Read the Bible Together plan. This is actually the passages from 2 weeks ago, but I flopped them from the ones for this week because the timing kind of worked out better. All right, but as we do this with reading from Luke's biography of Jesus, we'll see the lectionary actually has the same trouble that we do. So in the reading recommended for preachers today, the plan for this passage was to read the first 11 verses and then skip a few verses and read the last one and kind of skip over some of the troublesome parts near the end. But never one to back away from a challenge, I saw the opportunity here to include these verses and to do the topic we're doing today. So here they are, the approved and not so approved verses from today's reading in Luke 10. It's on your program, I believe, and it goes like this. After these things, we won't get into, but there are some things happening. The Lord commissioned 72 others and sent them on ahead in pairs to every city and place he was about to go. He said to them, "The harvest is bigger than you can imagine, but there are few workers. Therefore, plead with the Lord of the harvest to send out workers for his harvest. Go. Be warned, though, that I'm sending you out as lambs among wolves. Carry no wallet, no bag, and no sandals. Don't even greet anyone along the way. Whenever you enter a house, first say, 'May peace be on this house.' And if anyone there shares God's peace, then your peace will rest on that person. If not, your blessing will return to you. Remain in this house, eating and drinking whatever they set before you, for workers deserve their pay. And don't move from house to house. Whenever you enter a city and its people welcome you, eat whatever they set before you. Heal the sick who are there and say to them, 'God's kingdom has come upon you.'" Sorry, random, but I love that it's like, oh, eat whatever people give you and heal the sick. Like, you're too things to do. All right. "Whenever you enter a city and people don't come to welcome you, go out into the streets and say, 'As a complaint against you, we brush off the dust of your city that is collected at our feet. But know this, God's kingdom has come to you. I assure you that Sodom will be better off on Judgment Day than that city. Okay, and here's all the stuff I'm supposed to skip. How terrible it will be for you, Chorazin. How terrible it will be for you, Bethsaida. If the miracles done among you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have changed their hearts and lives long ago. They would have sat around in funeral clothes and ashes, but Tyre and Sidon will be better off at the judgment than you. And you, Capernaum, will you be honored by being raised up to heaven? No, you will be cast down to the place of the dead. Whoever listens to you listens to me. Whoever rejects you rejects me, and whoever rejects me rejects the one who sent me. So Jesus again gets a little steamed toward the end of this bit, and again you can perhaps see the direction that kind of Jesus' words take, why the lectionary, the preaching Bible reading plans for churches, skip over the part that we're actually going to focus in today. But before we focus in on the later part of the reading, I want to note that the parts of this passage that are included in today's lectionary have been really helpful to me over the years. Jesus is commissioning his apprentices to partner with him in doing a good work in the world. As we see, the renewing work of God on this earth is not just for Jesus, but for all of Jesus' students. Still true, I believe. So similarly, Jesus' ongoing work of renewal in the world is not just for a subset of religious professionals. You can use whatever language you want for God's work, but good news work, or kingdom work, or family of God work, salvation work, is Jesus' commission to all people to partner in with Jesus. We also see that God's good work in the world, Jesus' work he invites us into, is fundamentally a work of healing. Help people be well, Jesus says, and then you can tell them they are experiencing God's ways in the world. Jesus also tells us that as we find our way in the world and we find our way in the healing, renewing work of God we're invited to be a part of, we shouldn't ever go it alone. Jesus seems to indicate that good things are done in pairs, they're done in teams, they're done with partners and with friends. And Jesus seems to know that if we have a lot of stuff, it can distract us. It can kind of weigh us down, that living simply, living in a focused way, has power and has freedom. There's also this interesting advice Jesus has to publicly shake the dust off of your feet when people are unresponsive to the best, most beautiful thing you have to offer from God. I think that's really liberating too in my experience. Two different times in my life, I've had three-year work stints, which were really hard and really enormously humbling at times. And in each of these three-year work stints I'm referring to, my challenges were partly of my own making, right, as they always are. I was no perfect person in these situations. But I was also treated really inhospitably by some other people in both of these times of work. And each time, I felt like the best of what I had to give, or the best from God I had to offer, wasn't fully received. And each time on my final day, literally as I walked out of a building where I worked for the last time, I shook the dust off my feet. I literally started kicking my feet and stuff. I probably looked odd to whoever saw me, but I was in this symbolic gesture trying not to carry the experience with me, right? Which is really hard to do after hard experiences, but to try to not internalize other people's stuff, to not make rejection or even failure, to not kind of carry that on in my identity as part of who I am. I think this is a really powerful spiritual practice we can engage in moments of rejection or in moments really of any kind of transition. But then Jesus moves into trickier territory, so tricky again that our Bible plan recommends skipping it, at least for public reading or teaching. Because he tells the students when they shake the dust off their feet, they should do so telling these unresponsive communities out loud that it represents God's judgment against them. And now for various reasons, I don't recommend this be your regular spiritual practice in times of rejection and transition, to be like, ha, you may reject me, but you're the one going to hell. Ha! Not a winning move, usually for either side, I don't think, to act that way. But it is what Jesus has to say in this time and place. Now, he actually doesn't say the word hell at all. When we hear this, we usually supply a word like that, and we'll come back to this. But Jesus does talk very vividly about judgment. Now, the two primary things that Jesus and the whole of the New Testament, the part of the Bible that engages the story of Jesus and his first generation of followers, the main things that it has to say about judgment are that God is judge, not us, and that whatever God's judgments are or aren't, we will likely find God's judgments surprising. So Jesus famously says that God is in a position to see and know and fairly judge all people and institutions and cultures, characters and motives and worth. But however we work out of the details of this, we are not in such a good position to do that. And so we should trust God to judge, and we should try to cultivate a generous and non-judgmental attitude toward others and toward ourselves. Jesus also says God's judgments will again and again surprise us. The basic point of this section we're reading today, that when Jesus gets really steamed, is that Jesus' neighbors are really happily rejecting him, but that they're much worse off than these faraway towns and regions they look down upon. I think as if to say anytime we think we're God's chosen, or we're God's favorites, or we are uniquely God's faithful, and then we look judgmentally at other people that we think that's not true of, it may be a good sign that God thinks the opposite, that thinking that you're God's favorite is a pretty good sign that at least right now, you're not. But even as Jesus commands us not to judge and encourages us not to presume we know who and how God judges, he still sometimes talks about God's judgment as if there's something we need to internalize or reflect upon when it comes to God's judgment now and in the future. And I want to mention three ways that we've tended to hear Jesus when he speaks about God's judgment. The first of those, and by far the least common and kind of contemporary conversation in my experience, is judgment as exposure. Judgment as an act of revealing the truth that has at least partially been hidden. The exposure of secrets as a form of God's judgment isn't much discussed, but it's really common in the scriptures, and I think it's really timely too. Jesus says elsewhere, it's in Luke 8, in the Gospel of Luke, that there's nothing hidden that will not be disclosed, that there is nothing concealed that will not be known and brought to light. And one form God's judgment takes is the disclosure of things that should have never been secret in the first place. This kind of exposure is so hard and so necessary, so good, I believe. We all know that really toxic and harmful things are usually deliberately said and done in secret. And so these things, their original impact and much of their ongoing harm kind of hides in the shadows. And Jesus tells us that God will expose harm that is said and done in secret. And then people and cultures and institutions can decide to deny and defend, as usually happens, but then they'll be opposing God's judgment. So the other choice, that we can agree with God's judgment when exposed, is to acknowledge the truth, to feel sorrow, to make amends, and to commit to healing. This, maybe you're already thinking, is of course timely in like 100 ways. Because my sense, I've talked about with a couple of you, is that in public life in the U.S. right now, we may be under this kind of judgment. I think this sort of revealing of secrets, toxic secrets long hidden, is at the heart of the Me Too movement. It's at the heart of the Black Lives Matter movement. It's part of what's going on in the political life of our country, however you see and interpret things. I think we live in times where much harm that's been done in secret is being exposed, where a great deal of old public sin, be it white supremacy, be it misogyny, be it racism, be it sexual abuse and assault, a lot of old public sin is being exposed. And for me to interpret this, again, it's my subjective interpretation, but for me to interpret this as at least in part a form of judgment has been really helpful for me. Here's why. Again, it encourages me as a follower of Jesus to never assume I'm all in the right, and just to heap judgment on other people I think of as far worse than me. It encourages me to be humble and circumspect, right? Like, what's my part in public sin or whatever, right? To trust that God's the judge. It also encourages me that the Spirit of God may be prompting a work of healing in the place and culture where I live in my lifetime. This is, of course, not guaranteed, right? Because if we or anyone else denies or defends against the revealing truth of what God is doing, it's just going to continue. But I do believe God exposes only to heal. And so if God is in any way involved in like the times of great exposure that we're living in, perhaps it's to change and heal. Again, this is sort of my speculation, but that gives me hope. More often, though, when Jesus and the scriptures speak of judgment, they don't just speak of like the exposure that may lead to healing, but they speak of judgment as consequence. That despite what happens today, eventually, people tend to get at least some of what we deserve. It's obviously not true in the short run. Life is often, maybe usually, unfair. On the plus side, too, God is often really gracious, giving us more and better than we deserve. But in the long haul, kind of, we'll generally speaking reap what we sow. Our passage from Luke is accompanied in the lectionary by an excerpt from the Bible's letter to the Galatians. It says just this, so three verses of that excerpt. It says, "Make no mistake, God is not mocked. A person will harvest what they plant. Those who plant only for their own benefit will harvest devastation from their selfishness. But those who plant for the benefit of spirit will harvest eternal life from the spirit. Let's not get tired of doing good, because in time we will have a harvest if we don't give up." So not always, especially not in the near term, but in the long run, people and institutions and cultures tend to eventually get what we deserve. Now, there seem to be, again, exceptions to every rule. The Bible certainly implies that God's long-term goal is to give each person and all of humanity more and better than we deserve. That's what sort of what the word grace implies. But still, the basic rule of thumb that the Bible, and actually most of the earth's religious and wisdom literature affirms, is that in the long haul, we get what we deserve. That actions, habits, ways of being carry consequence. I wonder again, me speculating for a moment, if this isn't what's going on, like big picture, with the religion of Christianity in America. This is again just me speculating, but maybe a religious tradition that has done harm to most humans is now experiencing the inherent consequence of that harm. I was at a pool party in my neighborhood recently, and a Jewish acquaintance of mine, like, learned I was a pastor and was like, I have a question to ask a pastor. Like, why amongst my Jewish culture do we so define ourselves of like not being Christian? It's like the main thing it means to be Jewish. I'm like, I have a few stories I could tell you of why that is so. Like, do you want to talk about this? All right, this religious tradition, a white dominant, male dominant expression of Christianity, both in the European and American tradition, has often done harm to women, has often done harm to people of non-white race, non-Anglo ethnicity, non-Christian religion, often done harm to children, often done harm to sexual minorities, done harm to the earth. And shockingly, like in the times we live in, people are losing interest in that tradition. For some of us, in our tradition, when you think of it that way, historic, you're like, there are a few reasons. So if there's a future for Jesus-centered faith, as I believe there is like a robust, amazing future for Jesus-centered faith, if there's a future for Jesus-centered communities, which again, I'm like totally on the side of, then I think, wow, at least in the so-called West, it's going to look really different. And maybe again, that's not a bad thing. Maybe that's because of judgment as consequence. Like people, cultures, institutions sort of get what they deserve in the long haul. So I've talked about God's judgment as taking the form of exposure and of consequence. But the third way people hear Jesus and the Bible's words about judgment is judgment as divine punishment. That God intervenes in history, either now or in the future, or both, to punish evil people, to punish wrongdoing, wrongdoers, to punish injustice, or just to punish like unresponsiveness to God. And this is usually where hell comes in. Now, as you know, lots and lots of Christians, not all, but many, have thought that there is an awful place called a hell that God sends some people, or maybe many people, after they die, to be punished forever. This view or theology of hell, which is maybe the most common view or theology of hell, at least amongst 21st century Christians, is called technically eternal conscious torment. So three words to describe how long it lasts, eternal, how aware you will be of this experience, conscious, and how awful it will be, torment. That's like the technical theological jargon for this understanding. Someone, when they heard I would be preaching about hell, asked me, I think in jest, if I will tell people exactly how hot it's going to be. So let me just say that in the eternal conscious torment version of hell, this weekend is like just warming up, right? It's like only the littlest foretaste. Now, quick pause. Everything I've said up until now, I'm actually fairly certain about. This section of the talk about hell I'm about to give, though, I'm really glad I'm giving. It's what I believe. It's my best attempt at what's true and what's helpful. That said, if you disagree with me or aren't persuaded, again, that's okay. This is not a topic that Christians all agree about, let alone like people interested in Jesus from, you know, other faith tradition or no particular faith tradition. So all to say, there's room for, you know, disagreement here, but hear me out. Because I think that this eternal conscious torment view of hell has some really major problems. It's not the most historic view. It's not, in my opinion, the most biblical view. It's not particularly honoring of the God we know in the person of Jesus. And it has had, inarguably, some really bad fruit. So I want to take those one by one quick before I present another way of thinking about hell. Again, it's not the most historic view. So there was some division amongst the early church fathers and mothers, kind of leading followers of Jesus over the first 3 centuries after Jesus' ministry, about whether there would or wouldn't be a place of punishment after death, about who would go there if there was such a place, about how long they'd stay if there was such a place, and whether they could ever get out. These were all things that were like subjects of debate for several centuries. The division actually largely played out amongst geographic lines in the early church. So church leaders further east, places like modern-day Greece, Turkey, Egypt, they tended to think hell would be limited and that it would be more temporary, and that God's inclusive mercy would prevail for all or most people. And church leaders further west, so think contemporary Rome, Italy, kind of north central, northwest Africa, they tended to think that more people would go to hell and that they would stay forever. So Catholic and later Protestant churches, which is largely the American and most of the European Christian tradition, developed this Western side of the tradition, which actually in the early centuries was not the most common view. Hell as forever punishment for lots and lots of people after death also doesn't best reflect all the teachings of the Bible. Our modern American picture of this hell owes more to a 15th century epic Italian poem called Dante's Inferno than it does to the writings of the Bible. Much of the Bible's language that gets translated as hell in English is actually from the Bible's allusion to a shadowy place of the dead. It's interfaith language picked up from the old Middle Eastern and Greek mythologies and kind of poured it into the Bible when the kind of mystery and terror of death is being discussed. That's most of the language that's translated hell. And then there's this word Gehenna that Jesus uses now and then that also gets translated as hell. This comes up in only 4 scenes in the life of Jesus. It's a word that's used 11 times in the 4 Gospels, actually never in the 4th, just in the first 3 Gospels. Mostly it's just used in 1 of the Gospels, Matthew. And so I'll come back to this word, Gehenna, which Jesus uses an Aramaic version of 11 times. But I'll just say that when Jesus talks about Gehenna, as he does occasionally, it's not at all clear that he means what we think of when we think of hell. I think he's talking about something slightly different, in fact. All to say, though, not necessarily the most biblical view. Thirdly, this view of hell as eternal conscious torment, I don't think it's especially honoring of the beautiful God we come to know in the person of Jesus. Early in my years of faith, I was taught accurately that in Jesus we discover that the first and primary quality of God is love. I was also taught, a little less accurately, that you could read the Bible as a love letter from God to you. I don't think this is like the best way of understanding the Bible anymore. It's not like all wrong, but the Bible's not mainly like a love letter to me. It's some other things, but we'll run with this notion of Bible as love letter for just a minute. And so just imagine a love letter when someone says, "My darling, I love you like fully, completely, totally, deeply, passionately. But by the way, if you don't love me back, just like so, in a certain number of years, I will punish you with fire and misery and suffering forever." We would not call that love. I wouldn't call that love, right? We'd call that threatening. We'd call that, I don't know, abusive. We'd be like, run away from that so-called love letter. Now, if this is the truth of God in history, I mean this in all humility, like, so be it. I'm not God. I don't get to make the rules. None of us do. And so if this is the truth about God in history, like, we need individually, kind of collectively, to grapple with that. But I think if this is the truth, we wouldn't call it love. And I don't think that this is the truth anyway. Lastly, before what I do think the truth is, this view of hell as eternal conscious torment for all unrepentant sinners has also inarguably had some really bad fruit historically and in our times. A few years back, my wife Grace and I, along with Ivy and Scott Anthony, my fellow pastor is just up here, a husband is a board member here, we traveled to the Midwest to attend an event for people who were still interested in Jesus, but were having a hard time with their Christian church roots. And as we had conversation after conversation with people and kind of what trouble were they having, it was surprising to me just how often hell came up. It came up a lot. People have been threatened. They've been threatened, if you believe this, or if you don't believe that, you're going to hell. People's sweet old Christian grandmas, who they basically loved dearly on the whole, had told them if they do this or that, or if they even think this way or that, they're going to hell. And all these threats did not drive people closer to God. They just gave them like a mix of confusion and resentment and fear. Not good fruit at all. I heard in all these stories the other bitter, bitter fruit that this teaching of hell has had over the centuries historically, which is that people who have taught most often about hell were usually, as I said earlier, quite sure they knew who God was sending there. And they knew it was people of other cultures, people of other races, people of other religions, people of other sexual orientations. Even people who claimed to love Jesus and were honestly wrestling with the Bible and the Christian tradition, but coming to different conclusions. Believing that God sends some set of humanity to a post-death eternal punishment has historically served as an invitation to people to help God get them there. So it's like the great, I don't know, great percentage of Christian violence, like literal kill people violence and like violence sort of like just mean, hard speech with your words, has actually had connections to this particular theology of hell. Like, well, if I know that God's sending you there anyway, like, that makes you less than, and I can, you know, kill you, threaten you, whatever. It's led to all kinds of violence in the name of God, which might be just about the worst, certainly the most harmful form of toxic religion. So the first thing I want to say today, maybe like the simplest, most basic thing I want to say, is that if you were raised on this teaching about hell, and it has served you, or it serves you still, again, I'm not 100% confident, like I'm right here, there's room for you here, and room for your views here, very much so. But if you have been raised in some way on this teaching about hell and it's sort of done you harm to your life or your faith or your relationships, like, I am so sorry. Historically, this teaching on hell has never been at the center of a Jesus-centered faith. It's always been something that people, you know, at least in the early days, were free to disagree about. And it doesn't need to be part of a Jesus-centered faith at all. So again, if that's done you harm, like, just know it does not have to come with the package. I'm so sorry. So I join many Christians now and throughout the past two millennia in not being a big fan of this eternal conscious torment understanding of hell, which I kind of belabor and talk about because it is so common today. And I know many people in the room have heard lots about that understanding. You hear the word hell, and that's all that comes to mind. So given that's not the only way we need to understand things, what can we do with these times Jesus seems to talk about exclusion, or Jesus talks about Gehenna? There are these kind of 11 verses in Matthew, Mark, and Luke that gets translated as hell in most English Bibles. Or when Jesus talks about the suffering people might face when they don't welcome God's good presence and work in our lives. And what do we do with some of the Bible's like more colorful judgment material, like some of the stuff near the end of the final book of the Bible called Revelation? If you want a really deep dive on this, you can't get it all today. Like, I've got a few more minutes. So we had a Bible guide I wrote in Revelation a couple years ago in Lent. That's available on our website. You're welcome to kind of dig through in that. There's a really great short book on this topic. There's a lot of books on this topic I like, but the shortest, most accessible one is by someone named Brad Jersak. It's called Her Gates Will Never Be Shut. And that'll be in like the sermon notes, you know, up online this week as well. So if you want a deep dive, there are other places to go. But in just a couple of minutes, I'll share a perspective that takes seriously the metaphorical and historical and literary context of the Bible, as well as the powerful, inclusive love of God that insists all people need a type of judgment, but that mercy also triumphs over judgment. In this view, when Jesus talks about Gehenna, we start by recognizing that he was talking about a specific geographic place, like people knew how to get to the place, like right now that he was talking about. It was a valley just outside the gates of ancient Jerusalem. This valley, Gehenna, was a place that the prophet Jeremiah said centuries earlier, a child sacrifice had occurred in ancient times against the will of God. It was also a place that Jeremiah warned would become a mass gravesite after Imperial Babylon attacked and destroyed Jerusalem in the 6th century BC. It was a place, we don't know if this is true or not, there's some debate, but a place that legend has it, at least, had become an unending kind of smoldering garbage dump. A place that, again, would become a mass gravesite after the cataclysm of Rome's destruction of Jerusalem, just a few decades after Jesus' ministry. This was Gehenna, like an actual place just outside Jerusalem. And Jesus, as a prophetic teacher to his people, warned them again and again of the suffering they and their children could experience in this life, and perhaps in the next as well, if they didn't respond to God's ways of healing and peace for them. So in this understanding, hell is partly a metaphor for the real wages of sin. Like what living off the mark, kind of what consequence it brings in our lives, suffering and death. When we miss God's mark for our lives, and for the systems and the cultures we create untold suffering and death. We unleash hell. I watched the old Russell Crowe Roman film Gladiator with my boys for the first time this weekend. I don't know if it's objectively like a great movie, but for reasons that are probably quirky to me and when it came out, I really love this film. And this line near the beginning when the Roman general is leading an attack on a resistance movement in Germany. One of my kids was asking, as this was happening, like, are we supposed to be rooting for the Romans or the Germans? Which that was a really insightful question, because the movie is asking us, for a moment at least, to kind of sit empathetically with both sides in this battle. So my kid was really onto something. But then when the battle is about to begin, it sort of takes on the Roman perspective, and the general, played by Russell Crowe, tells the commander of the archers and the catapults, on my word, unleash hell. And then it happens. Hell before our eyes. The fire and violence and devastation of war is, in fact, an experience of hell. All the bitter fruit and suffering violence that violence in all forms causes is a form of hell. Every time you've heard someone tell you a story, every time you've read a story that kind of expands your notions of the horrors of what humans can do to one another, and this earth, you are hearing and reading about hell. The shame, the isolation, the mental and physical torture some of us have experienced in some measure. All of us have heard or read about all the worst, most evil, shockingly common episodes in history like this are the unleashing of hell on earth. We know that hell, in this sense, is very real because we have been there. Or we have seen it, or we have heard it, or maybe we have in part caused it for others. Hell, as the bitter consequence of humanity at our worst, makes a lot of sense in the gospel passages that mention it. Reaping the consequences that we sow for one another. And God's position in regards to this hell isn't sending people there, but mercifully rescuing people, calling God's children into partnership in works of healing that rescue some people from hell and make sure we don't create it in the first place for others. And then to the extent that this godless suffering continues into and beyond death, a loving God's position is the same, to mercifully extend love and invitation into hell until all are responsive to love and are rescued, until hell itself can be no more. This orthodox biblical take, one of the orthodox biblical takes on where and what hell is, again, is that hell is a metaphor for the suffering and death that human sin create in this life, and that hell is also the state of isolation and death beyond the grave for people who are not yet disposed to respond to the love and grace of God. After all, the passionate and good mind and spirit and force that is God is said to be experienced as love and grace by some, and is like fire and threat and intrusion by others. So hell is not punishment, because the longing of God is to love and to restore and to heal, not to punish. Hell is what we are and what we do and what we get even when we are not yet open and disposed to love. Again, this is just a short take in one day's sermon, but what's the upshot of this view? Where's it going? I think three places of good fruit. A Jesus-centered, love-colored understanding of judgment and hell will reduce our fear and increase our sense of accountability. The law of consequence, that we reap what we sow, that the God of justice will ensure that all people will be accountable for what we do in this life and in the next. What we do in the light and in secret. This, in my opinion, is really healthy for us all to know and believe. And yet is for all of our good. That there's nothing to fear in Jesus. For perfect love, the scriptures tell us, cast out fear. Secondly, a Jesus-centered, love-colored understanding of judgment and hell has no room for human exclusion, rejection, disgust, or judgment of others. This doesn't mean we have to be nice and chummy with every human alive. There are people that aren't safe, or at least aren't safe to some. There are people and situations that require some distance or some boundaries for the sake of everyone's health and welfare. But the way of Jesus is for all of human life and culture to be characterized by loving humility, to long for flourishing for ourselves and all others, to hope for abundant life in this life and the next for all people, and to not presume that particular people are less than or unaccepted or undervalued by God or by us. And lastly, a Jesus-centered, love-colored understanding of judgment and hell should and can nurture in us fearless hope for ourselves, for all humanity, past, present, and future, and for all this earth and times we live in as well. There are a couple, like, as we always have, sort of like take and run with this kind of thoughts in the program, but rather than say them, I'd love to pray with us for a minute and kind of pray us into a response to the words and reality I think Jesus would like to wrestle with us. So if you could, let's take a couple moments of sort of stillness, silence, and I'd love to pray us through a response. You obviously are welcome to just kind of sit still and tune me out and have a moment of quiet, or to kind of listen and participate with where I want to guide us to, but we'll give this just a moment. As you're still and silent, I'd like to invite you for a moment to go to kind of a hard place. So choose how hard of a place you want to go to, depending on what you're up for today. But we'll kind of go to a hard place in our mind and then invite God to be present for us and with us there. So I invite you to call to mind something in this life of ours. It could be personal, or it could just be something you're aware of or read about, of great evil. From your perspective. And you can call to mind what you feel ready to think about, but call to mind a situation, a circumstance that you consider just tremendously harmful and evil. Just call that to mind for a moment. And God, as I invite us to think of something really hard and invite you to join us in it. I pray, God, that by your Spirit, you'd be alive and real and timely to each of us in the room that need that in this moment. So as you think of a kind of situation or circumstance that you'd consider of great evil or great harm, I invite you to consider for a moment, to ask God, like, God, how are you present in this circumstance or situation, longing and working for love, mercy, peace, healing, and flourishing? God, could there be like an unveiling, a revealing of how you are present now in this life to work for love, mercy, peace, healing, and flourishing? God, is there good news you'd like to share in the hearts and minds of people in this room? I'll ask one more thing, too. I'll ask is, if you sense in any way sort of God present to this circumstance of great evil or suffering, is there any way that God would like to invite you to welcome God's presence, or even to join God, to partner with God in love, mercy, peace, and healing? God, help us to see or experience our connection, our welcoming, our receiving of your merciful presence, or perhaps our joining you in partnership with your merciful work and presence. God, I feel like my confidence, my experience, this comes in and out, but it is my sure hope that in all places of evil and judgment and suffering, that you are present for mercy, that you are present for love, peace, healing, and flourishing. My prayer, God, that we be people of sure hope in your mercy, that in our hardest suffering and pains, that we'd welcome your presence, and in the hardest suffering and pains that we kind of see and hear and know of, that we'd have hope that you're there, God, and that sometimes there's an invitation for us to join you there, to be people of your mercy as well. God, could you reduce fear in us? Could you grow hope in us? Could you kind of expand the amount of time in our days and weeks in which we have a deep and confident hope in your merciful and loving and good presence to all people in all the earth, past, present, and future, and all of this life and in the age to come. We love and trust you as a beautiful God.